This is a story about our town. Well, not so much about our town as it is my personal relationship to it. I've been thinking about it a lot lately because I am always thinking about that play. But I've really been thinking about it lately because that play just turned 80 years old. I've always felt a special kinship to our town because of where I grew up. The play is set in the fictional town called Grover's Corners, but that fictional town is in a very real place. Southwestern New Hampshire. I grew up in that area. The mountain mentioned in Thornton Wilder's play, Monadnock, rises above my hometown, giving it a sort of majestic postcard look. Thornton Wilder wasn't from that area, but did write the play while at the McDowell Colony in a town called Peterborough. Some say Peterborough is Grover's Corners. Was Grover's Corners. I lived in Peterborough for a while. I was around 10 years old. I remember it as the town where my imagination was born. I didn't know the Webbs, Gibbs, or Simon Stimpson were buried there. I remember when I first read Our Town, I knew nothing about the play other than some people found it boring. I remember finding it boring for a second until I realized it was set in New Hampshire. Then they mentioned Mount Monadnock and I thought, damn, this is where I live. That's the moment my emotional connection was born. I will now see literally any production of it. I don't care if it's a regional theater or a high school theater. I will see them all, and I will cry during Act 3. Every single time. A few years ago, I was reading the news from my hometown, and I caught myself saying something I thought only old people said. I said, "Back in my day." My hometown has changed so much since I moved away. It isn't like it was when I was growing up. Like many small towns in the United States, big problems like heroin and opioids and guns found their way there. Crime went up, shopping centers were planted on open fields, and some people who might not normally do so decided to move away. It made me sad to see this happening. But I realized the evolution of small towns is the constant. I thought about how it's not the same as it was when I was a kid. And my parents could say the same thing. So could their parents and their parents, all the way back to 1901, the year of Our Town's Act 1. I decided to write a play about my hometown, and I really didn't realize at first that I was covering ground Thornton Wilder covered succinctly 80 years earlier. When I realized my small town play was already written, I decided to sort of own it. Write mine as a response, or companion, or homage, or whatever. When I did this, I thought I was doing something kinda special. This is my play about my place, holding hands with that famous play about my place. My personal feelings gave me a sort of propriety that I wasn't really entitled to. I found that out when I started to show this work to people. I was told, "Hey, did you know so-and-so wrote in Our Town?" "Oh yeah, there's a bunch of these Our Towns floating around." Turns out, bazillions of playwrights have their own unique and special relationship to that play. I have seen and read a few of them, and they're good. It's a weird feeling to think you've done something meaningful and unique to learn that you're only as unique as all the others who have done the exact same thing. I was bummed when the rejections started rolling in. Each time I was told somebody else's version was better, I felt a little bruised. But you know what helped soften the blow? A little stroll through Grover's Corners. A peek into the Gibbs kitchen. Listening to Simon Stimpson conduct the choir. It was calming. It sort of grounded me. Ultimately, I love that there are so many playwrights out there with their own responses to that great work. It really isn't so bad to walk down the streets of their Grover's Corners. I'm glad I wrote what I wrote because it makes me feel that much more connected to Thornton Wilder's original. And how I feel was the point all along, wasn't it? That's the end of the first act, friends. You can go smoke now, those that smoke. American Theater Magazine's The Subtext. This is a podcast where playwrights talk about all those things that make them move, all the itches they need to scratch, and all the little things that make the itches itch. I am the host, Brian James Polak. On this episode, I talk to Ike Holter, a playwright I've been dying to meet and talk to ever since I first came to Chicago last year. Ike and I sat in the theater at Victory Gardens in Chicago. We talked about the posses of Chicago theater, the future of the city, Marvel movies, and the fictional 51st Ward. You know, I know that you grew up in Minneapolis, and I know that you went to DePaul. I'm curious what hooked you into staying in Chicago while you were studying as an undergrad and not, you know, go back to Minneapolis or go back or, you know, venture off to another place.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a writer, it's what I do, and I was talking to a director friend a few days ago. Side note, I was talking to this person. They were like, "Oh, well, you know, like I try to work on a lot of new plays, but I work on plays that have been, you know, obviously run for a few years too." And I was like, "Oh, that's funny. I only work on new plays. So since that is my job, the best place to do new plays in the country is Chicago. We have the best audiences. We have the best people working in lit, and this is a place that a lot of out-of-town writers go to try out new things because they know that there's something here that puts the work up instead of bringing things down to a weird level, which I think some cities can get in the trick of. So yeah, I mean, I went to school here. I was lucky enough to go to school here. And during school, I was like, oh, this is very interesting that when I'm in school, there's plays being nominated for Pulitzers and winning Pulitzers that are literally blocks away from where I live. And there's these people that I'm reading about in American Theater Magazine and all this other stuff. And they are my neighbors, basically. So why would I go somewhere else to try to get close to this when I can stay here and keep working on these relationships from the age of 18. So yeah, right. I've been here the whole time. I was lucky enough to do a residency in Minneapolis for a few months. Actually that was like six, seven months at the Playwright Center. That was in 2009. But yeah, minus that, I've been here the whole time. It's good.
But did you come into DePaul as a writer already? Like, were you already sort of focused? This is what I want to do.
Yes, I went to school for playwriting at DePaul, aka Abject Poverty. But yeah, I went to school there, and it was awesome, you know. Yeah.
But you already knew when you came in as an undergrad, as a freshman, you're 18 years old. You're like, I want to be a playwright.
That was my major. That's the choice I made as a child.
So at what point did you make that decision as a child?
I mean, I knew I wasn't good at doing anything but writing from the age of, like, 9. It wasn't, like, some process of, who am I?
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. It was like, cool, so I'm good at this one thing. There are many avenues to do this one thing. I was interested in a lot of different aspects of that, including being a lawyer, being a journalist.
Right.
All these things need good writers to do. But when I got into high school, I started writing plays, started writing one acts, and I was like, oh, this is not only fun, but I'm having a conversation with the audience that's better than, well, it's not better than, excuse me. I'm having a conversation with an audience that is much different than reading a book. I just say better than because I cannot write books. They're very hard. But when you're reading writing a book, you put it out, and if you want to get a reaction from someone, you can't go up to them when they're reading it because that'll look creepy, and they'll be like having a stoic face, and then they'll put it down and be like, I loved it, and I'd be like, I think you're lying to me. But with plays, you put them in front of an audience, you get instant reaction, you get instant feedback, you can change things pretty quickly. And I'm a communicator. I like, that's what I love about theater. You can adapt to the audience, the actors can change things, and the writer can change things. So yeah, I mean, I knew I wanted to.
Why was it plays? Like, why was it dramatic writing?
I mean, plays have the quickest reaction time.
Like, what connected to you when you were like, I know I can write, that's the only thing I can do.
Oh, sure.
But what triggered playwriting as like the form?
No, I get you. I saw a lot of plays when I was a kid. I went to the Guthrie Theater a lot,
yeah,
which I ended up working out. I went to the Guthrie Theater a lot. I saw plays there. And, you know, I saw plays at Mixed Blood and Jungle Theater. So I was seeing a lot of plays, and I was learning that, this is, you know, this is something you can, yeah. I just saw a lot of plays. I was like, I like plays. I think I could write some. I only knew of, I think, two black writers until I was in high school. So I actually didn't know if it was possible. I was like, is there still some weird rule and regulation about this?
Like,
am I allowed to do this?
Well, did somebody give you, I mean, I'm putting air quotes, but permission? Did somebody say, no, this is a thing you can do, do it?
I mean, I had great teachers who were like, oh, yeah, you should do this. But I think it was very funny. I saw a lot of shows as a kid, but what I'm remembering is that the only ones written by a person of color were by August Wilson. And I knew who Pearl Klee was, but I had never seen a Pearl Klee play.
Mm-hmm.
I just started writing, and people started doing them in high school, and it was very exciting. And then when it came time to go to college, I was like, well, since I can do one thing, I could do a fake major where I pretend like I'm really interested in X, but what I want to do is Y.
Right.
Or I could just go to somewhere and put myself whole hog into this and see if it works out. And I had some friends from Minneapolis, including Maggie Wagner, who is a writer that I worked with, who was at DePaul. She's like, it's great, come see it. And I did. And I was like, you're right, I'm going to go here. And I got in, and yeah.
Was that like your one single choice?
Yep.
Or did you have a bunch? That was it? It was like, yep, you're all in on DePaul?
Yep. Or else I wouldn't have gone to college. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think you would have done if you didn't end up going to college?
Probably this, just in a different way.
Yeah.
I think.
Did school create some kind of structure or opportunity that you may not have found if you didn't go?
I think the cool thing about school is different for everybody. I'm not a good student. I'm not a good student at all. I think a lot of people are really good students, and they will go to a lot of school, and they will like what they're doing.
Yeah.
I went to school not for, and this is going to sound weird, but I didn't go, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this without sounding like a dick, too. I went to school because I knew it was important, and I knew there were teachers
who I
wanted to learn from and cultivate. But the idea of assignments for playwriting and that kind of thing, still, it doesn't exactly make sense to me because I think even when I teach, I'm like, I'm going to teach you how to do the thing in my way. And every time I teach you something, I'm going to say, you have to find another way to do this thing that I do. I'm going to show you how I do it.
Right.
You saw how I did that? Don't repeat it because it will not work for you. You need to find your way to do that same thing.
Yeah.
So whether that's pumping out a first draft, I can pump them out in 5 days. Some people take 5 weeks. Some people take 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, here's how I did it so quickly. Look at all the flaws in that. Look at how crazy I am and find a way that's better than that and improve on that. So when I was going to school, I was being taught by people like Carlos Morello and Dean Corin and Robert O'Hara, who did that. They were like, I'm a working professional. This is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Follow me to a point, but then you need to figure out that because you're an artist and you have your own voice, and that comes from you, you know, deviating from the form.
Yeah.
This is the form. You get it? Cool. Do something else. But yeah, so I went there for that. I went there to do that.
Were you aware of this in real time, like as it was going on?
Yeah, I mean, I was such a bad student. I was like, if I'm going to be here, I'm going to be getting something out of it, which is learning from these people how they do their craft. Whereas the idea of learning, and I had amazing teachers who were like, this is how you do structure, this is how you do, et cetera. That stuff is in the back of my head always now, and I always learn that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, when I'm sitting down to write a play, I'm more apt to think of a piece of art that I already like and think of the structure of that and then work backwards. Whereas I think some people are like, I need to do an outline, I need to find my inciting incident.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I'll write. Things are naturally in there. After I have the first draft, I'll identify those things, you know, and then go from there. Yeah.
At what point did you think, I can actually make a life out of this? Like, were you still in school? You know, were you out of school?
Yeah, I mean, I won my first playwriting thing. It was from the Kennedy Center. I was like 19. So I went to, you know, they flew me down there. They put me up. They gave me a check. I was like, oh, this is cool. This is more than my rent.
Yeah.
So from that moment on, I was like, okay, if I keep working and not expect people to find me, if I expect myself to find other people, then what I have to do is put out stuff, get new audiences, and keep submitting. So yeah, I started getting my stuff done.
So you knew pretty early on, you're like, oh, you know what? I think I can do this. I think I can make this work.
Well, yeah, I mean, and this was the Bush years. You lived every day like it was your last, every night like it was Xanadu. Everybody was looking for some kind of, like, escape. So I did a lot of festivals that were about politics. I did a lot of these things and got and met cool people and had conversations. But yeah, I was, it kind of felt like, why just learn this? Why, you know, if you're in school, you should be submitting other places. You should be working in communities, sure, and you should be finding theaters that are storefront and et cetera. Otherwise, you're just a student, and there's nothing wrong with being just a student, but I knew I wanted to.
I think a lot of students do compartmentalize. It's like, I'm a student now, and then when I'm not a student anymore, then I will begin my career.
That stuff is so weird. I don't trust it. I mean, there's so many people I meet who are like, oh, I'm fresh out of school, and I want to know about the theater. And I'm like, you've been in Chicago for 4 years.
Right.
Why haven't you seen a show here, here, here? You've only seen shows that your school has done. That just, you know, I think we need to be proactive about getting out there, not just to support other artists, which is always a good thing, but to know what kind of places you can submit to know what kind of people you want to work with, and then to see who's making mistakes, who's making huge gains. Because if you're in school for it, you should be loving watching it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I saw a lot of shows outside of it, and many of those theaters I'm now working with, which is cool.
Did you have a, I don't know, for lack of a better word, a guide? Like, do you have a person that was like, hey, you got to look here. You got to try this. You should go to this theater.
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of people in and outside of DePaul who were really good with that. But I think one of the things that Chicago does is they're a very... It's a very group-centric city. It's a very legion, league, posse, ensemble town. Mm-hmm. So I had a tight group of people. We started a company when we were still in school, and people in those companies were working other places. So then that created a web. It's like, I know someone working at Red Orchid because this person's in my company. They're an intern there, but they're the executive manager here.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know this person who knows this person. So it was constantly spider webbing, and I was meeting a lot of people through that. And, you know, when you start getting in companies, you start meeting a lot more people and having a lot of respect for more people. And then everyone is available in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone wants to help you if you're starting out. Yeah.
Yeah, I've noticed there's a echoing kind of what you just said. There's this sort of like groups of posses around Chicago, and one way into the community is finding a posse for yourself.
Everyone is very identified by who they create things with, which I think is really cool.
Yeah,
I go to other cities, and it seems like a lot of different islands of people who are working. But in this, it's like lots of landmass. And these people, we proudly occupy this. We fill this niche. We serve this audience. And the great thing is people can go back and forth constantly. It's
right, there aren't
like,
walls around everybody. Like, what I love about this community is people don't exist in their bubbles.
Right.
You know, they're constantly.
Bubbles pop, they burst. But, people find their family really quickly. And I'm sure it's weird from an outside perspective, but the idea of, oh, I'm an actor, I'm not doing this alone. I'm really good friends with the director. That director's really good friends with the lit manager. That lit manager's really good friends with the lighting designer. We're all together in this. So even when someone is out of work, they're still part of this community and they're still contributing. And someone is still seeing them, and then they are still getting their end in somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
That is the best version of how that stuff works.
What... In this time period where you're, you know, you're starting your theater company in college and you're winning, you know, the Kennedy Center Awards and all that, did you encounter struggle? Like, were there periods of time where you were just like, shit, I don't know what to do?
Yeah, I mean, struggle in terms of...
I don't know, like paying your bills or getting work read or, you know, getting somebody to notice you.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I was an excellent poor person because I lived with a group of people that I was in a company with.
Mm-hmm.
that show, Hit the Wall, which you saw in Los Angeles, started in Chicago. Inconvenience. We were this company that lived in this huge loft in the tail end of the Bush years, through the Obama years, mm-hmm. and there were 13 of us living there. And it was a huge place. We did our own shows there. And we paid for utilities and things many times with parties we threw, with shows that we threw, with fashion shows that we let rent in there. And we became a company with that. We were like, oh, we're an ensemble-focused, large-scale company. Mm-hmm. People can rent out our space, but we have our own aesthetic. So they loaned me money. I paid it back. Sometimes I didn't. Mm-hmm. We helped each other out. And at the same time, we were creating shows that critics were going to, asking to review those shows. And we were like, actually, this is legal. You shouldn't. So that created a buzz around us. So right, even when we were struggling, there was this feel of, oh, this is serving a bigger purpose, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, I worked a million odd jobs. I wrote monologues for people to pay my rent. There's crafty ways of going around it. I just knew I love waiters. I can't be a waiter. My brain literally doesn't think like that. I wish I could. It would make everything so much easier. But I always tried to find an artistic way to pay these bills, et cetera, et cetera. I was an excellent poor person. I'm very crafty.
Yeah. Did you feel like you were just doing it, or did you feel like, man, this is hard and I'm having a hard time getting through?
It's yes. I mean, it's always hard. I don't think it gets easy. I think you learn how to do things better, but yeah, the idea of making your money off art is something that, I mean, I personally wake up every morning thinking, cool, I got to check my traps. I set a trap for this person, for this mm-hmm. company, for this thing. I got to check my traps. What's going on with this one? All right, cool. I still need to send them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm always auditioning. I'm always coming up with something. I'm always pitching something. I'm always getting turned down for something. I'm always getting ignored for something. I mean, that stuff still happens. It just happens on a different scale when you start having more productions, I think. But yeah, I mean, I get rejection letters more than I get thumbs up. But I think to the outside eye, someone's like, oh, you have four productions going on right now. That's so exciting. And I'm like, it is exciting. I am very proud of these and I'm very grateful to have them. But also, I got turned down from something that would pay my rent for 2 years. I got, these things happen. And they also, I think, stop... I'm a Midwest person. I'm from Minnesota. And the idea of ego is very odd to me. It doesn't, it doesn't make sense because it seems like someone is covering something up.
Right.
But if you ever want to lose ego quickly, it's, have something really work out and then literally the next day get dropped by your agent or et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it just puts you in a place of, being humble, I think, instead of, I got to get this next score.
Has that scenario happened to you?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yes.
Can you talk about it?
Not really. I mean, it's not that interesting.
I mean, it's interesting enough for me to want to hear about it.
What? I mean, there's always highs and lows. The higher you hit something, a low is, not too far behind usually with art, with stuff that's artistic.
Yeah. So when a low like that happens, instead of, diving into the nitty-gritty of, what caused it and all that, but when something like that happens, when a thing gets taken away, does it cause you to recalibrate the way you go about your work? Or do you think I'm just going to continue to follow my instincts and do what I do?
It depends. It's instance by instance. I don't think there's any big band-aid to put on the idea of depression or rejection. When it sucks, it sucks. When it's great, it's great. But when it is great, I'm always cautious about not just making sure that, when a play is cool and it's selling well, I never get stuck in the idea of, oh, this is great. Everything is super. Mm-hmm. Nothing can go wrong. I'm like, oh, I got lucky. I worked with a lot of really cool people. Instead of trying to recapture that again, I'm working on the next show.
Right.
And it's a clean slate, and I'm going to fall down a million times, and some things aren't going to work. So, yeah.
In and out.
I mean, it's tech time. People are.
Yeah. Everyone's got a lot of work to do in the theater.
Closing windows.
It's good. This is life in the theater.
If you are now listening, you will hear the sounds of the tech and design crew for Rightland bringing things up, taking things down. It's very exciting.
It is very exciting. We're actually witnessing the end of Indecent and the beginning of Rightland overlapping each other.
Yes, it is. Lovely. It is very simple stuff here, not complicated at all.
But what's actually kind of cool? What's actually kind of cool? This podcast, the last episode was Paula Vogel, author of Indecent. To the next episode,
so hot right now
is Ike Hoelter, author of the next play. It's crazy, uh-oh, crazy. So when you graduated and you were self-producing with your crew,
yeah,
how did you start to connect with the other companies around town, and who started to recognize you and want to do your work outside of your own crew?
Sure, yeah. We had a really good relationship with a Red Orchid Theater, which is in Old Town. It's on Wells Street. Kirsten Fitzgerald runs it. Michael Shannon is one of the members there. I was being taught by Brett Nevue, who is a writer there. He was my teacher in college, and it was very interesting. He's like, oh, I have this company. You should see some stuff we do. And I was like, sounds great, dude. And then I went down there. I was like, oh, this stuff is really lit. Okay. And then I started just going to their shows, not like out of an assignment, like, oh, I'm interested in seeing this production of this. And meanwhile, one of the people in my company, Walter Briggs, was an actor in their show there. And then one of our other people was the box office manager there, Brian Rad. So then gradually we started hanging out. I started seeing their shows. I started working in the box office, and it became like a 10-year long, like, oh, I'm a student. Now I'm a glorified intern, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm almost a peer, and now you're producing my work, which was Sender, which we did there a few years ago. But yeah, those things happen all the time. They're always great when they happen. And then there's other places that I've been going to since I was a teenager that, even though I've not had a show done there, mm-hmm, I've gotten close with the artistic staff, or I just have a big respect for their work. And now I'm to the point where I like pay for their tickets instead of getting the comps.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So those kind of, evolutions are fun too.
What was it about Red Orchid's work that kind of caught you?
They do the best dirty in Chicago, which is a weird sentence, but it's real. I think people think of the Chicago aesthetic and they imagine an SNL sketch of hairy, dirty, sweaty white men throwing chairs and talking like this.
Totally.
You know,
100%.
Like screaming.
Yeah.
But at Red Orchid, you are in a small space that's intimate, which is scary for a lot of audience members to be that close to a performer. And the acting style there is so fine-tuned.
Mm-hmm.
No one loses control. Even when it seems like an actor is about to reach a breaking point, they always go to the humanity instead of the big theatrics.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the shows that they pick tend to be more intimate and intelligent. They were one of the first people to do Bug by Tracy Letts.
Mm-hmm.
They have a unique style in that, you know, they cut through a lot of the bullshit and they just present the story as is. So that attracts a certain type of director, that attracts a certain type of actor, and you know, it attracts a certain kind of writer. Yeah.
Did it feel like a graduation when they eventually produced your play?
I mean, not really. I mean, I had known them in a lot of different capacities, the people who work there.
Yeah.
But it was really, really fun. It's always fun when, like, we're in Victory Gardens right now. I started seeing shows here when I was in college. And now they're doing one of mine.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't feel like a graduation. It's like, cool, this is the time that we get to work together, and hopefully it won't be the last time.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Red Orchid, same with all these places in town. There's a great theater called Jackalope that's done three of my long shows and like eight of my festival short length shows.
Mm-hmm.
And we grew up together. We're all the same age.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels the same. It's like, oh, I'm going back to a place I'm very comfortable in that feels home-ish.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't feel like a graduation. It feels like, oh, this is the place that I like to be in. And it feels normal, mm-hmm, I think.
I mean, it seems like you've worked with most of the theaters in town.
There are over 200 theaters in Chicago.
Do you want to work with all 200 of them?
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
I think that should be every writer's goal, because there's,
yeah,
so many different ones. But no, there's so many theaters here. It is crazy.
Yeah. Are there theaters that you wish you could work with?
There's a lot of theaters I wish I could work with. it's not for lack of trying. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some of those rejection letters that you talked about before are coming from some of those.
Yes, yes, they are. Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing. I don't take rejection to heart. It is disappointing, but at the same time, a rejection for me, and this is going to sound lame, but a rejection for me is something really good for someone else, especially if they have less. Then how can I be upset when someone who is getting their first production is getting, quote unquote, the slot that should have gone to me? But also I learned as a young writer of color that there's no such thing as the slot. There are, you know, different white people will let you do different things in their spaces. So yeah, I used to be told a lot like, oh, we already have a black writer this year. And that was something that you weren't supposed to be offended by back in 2007, 2008, 2009. They would willingly say that. Or, oh, sorry, we actually had a woman writer last season. It did not do well. So we're going to wait on that. They would say that stuff constantly. So the idea of me getting disappointed, it just doesn't work like that in my brain, especially if I know that, cool, so this theater isn't going to literally tell me we've done too many plays by Negroes. They're going to find an artful way of saying it, but what I know they're going to do is they're going to find another writer of color who they're going to pinpoint for whatever reason, be that good or bad, because optics are optics. But I always hope for the best, and I'm always happy for that writer. I've never been disappointed when something hasn't been allowed for me and it's been given to someone else, because it's a holistic thing. It's like, if I do a good show, then weird white people are going to say, oh, that person, that means he can vouch for other people. This is good. He showed me black people can write. That is a horrible way to think, but it still happens. It's the same whenever a woman of any color does something. They're like, oh, I didn't know that was possible. Maybe I should think about women writers. So I don't think a lot of us get upset at each other, because it's like we are so individual and we are just as well-read and well-written as these white men. But for a lot of people, it's the foot in the door thing. So one less for me is good for someone else, and that's all right.
Yeah, you mentioned the whole slot thing, and I was at Humana this year when you spoke.
At Humana, yes.
Yeah, and I thought what you said, and I don't know if you can recall what you said, but I thought what you said was awesome and important given the audience. Because you were speaking, it was live, but you were speaking to a national audience, because it was all of these people from different theaters across the country. Do you remember that?
I basically said that all the people that are winning tonight are people of color and women. So isn't it weird that no white men are here? It's almost like we do work on our own, and there are enough of us to fill seasons. So instead of just finding slots for us, maybe you should give us some years to fix the mistakes that white people have made. I don't know. But I think Victory Gardens works the same. They haven't done a play by a white writer in 2 years. And they've had some of their biggest hits in the last two seasons.
But
I think talking about that stuff is important. Like I said, I grew up not realizing there were more than a handful of writers of color. And not only that, but when I realized, it's like, oh, so we have this kind of, and I'm going to choose my words carefully here. I think that all I'm saying is that it doesn't make sense that there aren't seasons full of non-white writers. And until we do that, I don't think a theater can call itself progressive or et cetera, et cetera. If it's like five shows, three are by white men, one is by a dead person of color, one is by a woman that we found, and we're very happy to have her, but that's it. That that's not something that is a good mirror for 2018, 2019. And also it's something that's not going to age well. I mean, I go back and snoop at theaters' websites and I'm like, what were you doing during this crisis? What were you doing during this national tragedy? Oh, you were doing this, but you say you stand for this. That's a conflict right there. And I think you're full of crap. So yeah, I think it's now is a time for people to kind of put their money where their mouth is.
No, and that's what I thought was so awesome. Like you said, and you repeated, full seasons, full seasons, full seasons. And I was sitting there going, man, I hope these people who, a lot of them in this audience, who are decision makers, who are programmers, are being moved or at least taking it in. Because it might not be like an immediate,
right,
like the next season announced, but It's gonna,
I mean, but that's the thing. These
it should be, but
I'm friends with so many white writers who get called at the last minute as the season's being planned because there's a hole in the season because something has gone through. So things can actually shift very quickly. So I don't think any of these ideas are weird, and they should happen overnight. That's how, you know.
Yeah.
These, you know, some of these people run smaller theaters, and they are scared of X, Y, and Z. I understand that. I don't get it, but I understand it. I think people who run multi-million-dollar theaters and actually can take the chance to have risks. I've just, you know, learned from working these departments that the lie is it takes so long to change something. When really, I've seen them pick up the phone and call a white writer who's only had one production and give that show a headline slot on the biggest stage that they have for no reason other than that they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think this is a very good time to for people to step up quickly, because people of color are expected to react quickly. We're expected to be like, do you have a play about immigration in this timeline? This is really hot right now. Do you have a play about shootings? We're talking about shootings. Why aren't you reacting to the culture quicker? We need a play about this. We need a play about this. Whereas white people, I think, in leadership positions are allowed to take a long time to kind of suss out a writer or director or say, well, we're, you know, who can vouch for you?
Mm-hmm.
So I totally hear what you're saying, but I'm just saying it's not difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Coming out of school, I'm bouncing back, but to talk about the present, you had a group of collaborators, you had a group of people mm-hmm. that you made work with. Do you today still have a group? Or are you very much sort of like a free agent and you're kind of pinballing around depending on the project?
Yeah, I mean, I still have a very, 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 one more very, very tight Chicago family of people who I collaborate with often. Some of those people are Jackalope, even though I'm not a member of Jackalope Theater. Some of those people are in the Inconvenience, even though I'm not a member of the Inconvenience anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are nothing without a company. I started that company with a few people. I'm not a member of it, but I still think what they do is awesome, et cetera, et cetera. And then I have my own company called The Roustabouts. We do big-ass short-notice stuff. So we'll announce a show 7 days before or mm-hmm. a week before. It'll sell out. It'll fill up. People have a great time. But then it'll be done in 2 weeks. You know what I mean? Instead of a typical
so
5 week
pop-up
run.
Piece.
Sure, yeah, stuff yeah. like that. But yeah, I mean, and you know, we live in Chicago. It's hard not to kind of have those sex mm-hmm. groups.
Do you have a person or people who, when you're writing a first draft, you're like, I got to get so-and-so's eyeballs on this?
I work with dramaturgs a lot. I work with similar dramaturgs, like Kendra Miller has done a lot of my shows, Josh Altman, Oliver Sava, and directors, Lillianne Brown and Gus Maneri and Shade Murray. You know, these are people I go back and forth with. But every project is different. Some first drafts, I don't let anyone read unless it's the person who's going to be saying it or the person directing it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are you at this point writing, you know, when we first start out writing, we're kind of like, oh, I want to write this play. I've got this idea for a play, whatever the inspiration is, and we're writing it. And then we're like, okay, I've written this play now. I got to find a person to want it. Are you at a place currently where you're essentially writing commissions, or are you writing, you know, your own inspiration and then finding a home for it on your own?
I've never just written a play to write a play. I think, yeah, that's never changed. I've always written something because of a deadline. I go by deadlines. Even as a kid, I was like, I think I can write a play, but until someone put a deadline in front of me, I mm-hmm. didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same now. It's like, if no one's asking me to do something, I'm going to be seeing movies with my friends, throwing parties, or getting lit and watching TV. Do you know mm-hmm. what I mean? I have other priorities.
Mm-hmm.
But people have commission things, so I go by those commissions and I finish by or around the deadline. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, I'm not someone who has a trunk full of things that I've written and I've never seen eyes on them.
Mm-hmm.
I write for deadlines because mm-hmm. that's part of my process.
Yeah, yeah. When you were writing, a lot of people that are listening to this will likely be outside of the Chicago area, but those of us in Chicago are very much aware that you have this cycle of plays about this neighborhood, this fictional neighborhood of Chicago. And it's a cycle of seven.
It's a saga.
It's a saga.
S-A-G-A. Yeah, no, it's a saga of stuff. I think cycle implies something different, but this okay. is a long-form story told over these seven shows that take place
okay,
in one
thank
place.
You.
With characters popping up, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, seven shows. So, almost done.
Yeah, so you've got this saga of seven, and what's the first one of the saga? What would you consider the first one?
If we're going by plot things,
by when you actually wrote it.
Oh, Exit Strategy, was 2014 at Jackalope.
So when you wrote Exit Strategy, how aware were you of the larger, bigger picture saga?
I was aware that because I created this, because Exit Strategy is about this public high school that closes in Chicago, mm-hmm. not unlike one of the 50 schools that Rahm Emanuel closed overnight. Years and years ago. He's a horrible man. I said that out loud. He is a horrible man. So I was writing this, and I had friends who were teachers, and instead of saying, oh, this is this school, I said, I have to make a school up. I have to have free liberty with this. Mm-hmm. And to make up a school, you have to make up a ward. There's 50 wards in Chicago. So I said, here's the 51st ward. It's my own rules. I'm taking things from et cetera, but mostly these are fresh ideas put within this jurisdiction. So yeah, Exit Strategy was first. I was working on a commission for Goodman at the time, which became Prowess, which is set in the same neighborhood. I was like, cool, these work together. That same summer, I started working on a show called Sender, and I was like, these characters talk like people who went to this high school, mm-hmm. and et cetera, et cetera. Why don't I just embrace that? And then in 2016, Sender and Prowess played at the same time, Jackalope and Red Orchid, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, this is cool. The audience is having a different conversation now. Mm-hmm. Then a few months later, Wolf at the End of the Block happens with Teatro Vista running the upstairs of Victory Gardens. And that was the most like, oh, these people are speaking about things. And there was a reaction from the audience of like, oh, damn, I remember that. They're talking about that store. You know, and it was this great moment where I was like, oh, I think this is working mm-hmm. on a different level. Because the shows are the shows. You can do one. Like, an audience doesn't need to know, oh, actually, this is part of a timeline that exists outside. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to put on your nerdy Marvel glasses, even though I carry those with me everywhere. But, you know, the shows stand on their own. But if you know anything about the other ones, you're watching it from a different context and you're listening a lot differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I could go see Civil War, the Marvel movie, and have a fun time. There's superheroes fighting. But also if I know what Black Panther is really about, I'm watching that movie from a completely different landscape. And also, if I know the history of Iron Man and Captain America, my nerd glasses are fully on, then I'm watching it from a heightened perspective, not of spectacle, but actually drama.
Mm-hmm.
Because now at this point, it's something that's not just entertainment. It's like a saga. You are learning things differently from characters and from political stances, and it's causing seismic shifts. Whereas someone else is like, oh, that's a nice fight scene. And I'm like, yo, you don't even know. This is fucking like 7 years in the making. These motherfuckers go back. There was this one time, never mind. You know,
When did your saga become a saga? Like, you were clearly putting the pieces. You were putting the pieces together. You were like, oh, shit, this play goes with this play. These people come from the same high school.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a moment where you're like, oh, man, I get it. It's like a full, complete thing.
Yeah, I mean, with Exit Strategy, I knew the story of the neighborhood, like three sentences worth of story about how that came to be. So then I was like, oh, I know there's an alderman, I'll name drop her. And then two plays later, I have a person who works for that alderman. And then I was like, cool, I have four shows so far.
Mm-hmm.
I think it stops at seven. I think that's a good amount mm-hmm. of stories to tell in this place. But if I don't go crazy in 5 months, I'll start writing this one that's about this alderman that has this character in, who also I've been working on for this show. So it was all at the same time. It wasn't some, like, as soon as I sat down, I'm going to have these seven plays, et cetera, et cetera. It was a natural thing that mm-hmm. felt really good mm-hmm. and didn't feel like I was forcing anything. It was like, oh, if I'm getting these commissions and they want Chicago plays, I'm not going to make up seven different versions of Chicago. I'm going to make up one consistent one.
Yeah, yeah. It's similar to how some writer directors of film create mm-hmm. their own universe and set the. I guess use Marvel. It's a perfect example of the same sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, audiences like same with Stephen King. People do that a lot, and I think it's time for more theaters to start doing that stuff. The audience will have more familiarity with big, large stories, and they're ready for them.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't just happen once in a while. It's a pretty normal thing in television, books, and film,
yeah.
and music even. It's like, I mean, if we can deal with Garth Brooks saying, I'm now this person, and not have people being like, I don't understand this. Do I have to listen to the other albums? It's like, you know, it's pretty easy, fun stuff.
Right. And your work tends to cross genre, right, from play to play.
Oh, yeah.
So you aren't, and I know this because I heard this out of your mouth before, that you aren't a person that, and I'm going to paraphrase you to you.
Go there.
This is the stupidest thing I've ever said. You aren't somebody that's inspired by writing the same tone, the same type of work over and over again. And you actually alluded to that earlier in our conversation where you're talking about you find the structure and tone of a thing that you like, and then you deconstruct it and work backwards from there. And write.
I mean, tone is weird. It's like, yeah, tone is really, really weird. When I write a play that's about like a topic, I try to make that play really good so I don't have to do that topic again.
Mm-hmm.
I have a show called Loom that is the only thing I will hopefully ever write about an alien abduction. I love that play. But it's like, I filled everything I want to in here. Whereas with something like Rightlands, I'll do more plays that have politics in the future, but this is a piece about a person running, a story I've always wanted to tell. But so I put everything in there, and I know the book of genres that come with this kind of storytelling. I'm a big film and TV junkie, so I know the pitfalls of that. And with this one piece, I'm going to figure out how much of those I steal from and how much of those I circumvent, et cetera, et cetera. But also, if you're going to see a play by a writer, I don't know. I think you can listen for things like dialogue.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there a consistent thing? Is there a thread that connects?
I'm sure a lot of people could be like, oh, an Ike play is like this. I'm not really good at doing that. Yeah. I'm assuming it's like my characters talk at a specific pace and rate. Mm-hmm. There's lots of overlapping things. And I mean, I'm sure either a critic or a psychoanalyst could be like, Ike's plays do this.
Sure.
But I try to make them all really, really different. Because that's me as an audience member. I like seeing, like last night I watched Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I listened to Kendrick Lamar. And then I woke up this morning and played the new Streisand and read a comic book. Do you know what I mean? I'm a very weird person. But I think now we're in an age where people are embracing that. It's not a weird thing to be a nerd anymore.
Right.
It's actually something that is awesome and means you're pretty well read on stuff, and can go back and forth between tones and not have a problem with it.
Would you have considered yourself, or do you, looking back, consider yourself weird or nerdy growing up in, Minnesota?
I mean, I was always awesome.
Yeah.
Hair flip.
Right.
No, I mean, that stuff was, I always thought people who consumed a lot of media and were able to talk about it were pretty cool. And now we're in an age where it's like, oh, you haven't seen this meme, you don't know this Vine. It is a good thing to be well read up on stuff and be able to jump back and forth from viewing habits and political support and et cetera.
Right. Is there anything particularly Midwestern about what you write or how you write?
I mean, the Chicago things that take place in these seven plays, I think, are very Chicago, which is in the Midwest. So sure, I could say that. I will say that I think there is a certain type of writer that comes out of grad schools. And I've read scripts where it's like, oh, this person went to a specific grad school and they have that kind of aura about them. I think that stuff is awesome for certain writers. I can't do stuff like that. So I don't think maybe it's about location. I think it might be I stopped going to school after I got my BFA. There's a lot of people who go to grad school and they have this different way of writing, which I really appreciate, but I can't emulate.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's, I don't know if that's location specific or education specific.
Well, I meant more like you describe yourself as a Midwestern person, you know?
Sure.
And sort
yes.
of like, what does that mean? And does whatever that means, is that seen in your work?
I mean, it's not something I consciously think about when I'm writing. But in terms of me as a person, I think when I am with people from the opposite coasts, I do think there are certain things that I just, I mean, I don't even want to go into it that much. It's very minute things, but I couldn't point them out in my work, I don't think.
What do you want to write that you haven't written?
Oh, sweet. Yeah. What do I want to write that I haven't written? I want to write some old school, like folk inspired epic, which has a big cast, which has several locations, which has fire on stage, water on stage, dirt on stage. It's like a you know, it's one of those old school like adventure yarns that
on.
Maybe has two and for like maybe has like two intermissions. It's over 3 hours long.
Yeah.
But I want to do an old school epic with all people of color in the cast, written and composed and created, directed. And I've been surfing on a plot for years, but it's one of these things where it's like, oh, if I had the opportunity to work at Looking Glass Theater, that would be the only thing I present to them.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's something that when I work with storefront companies, I'm not going to bring them something that has a huge tidal wave in it. You know, right, like a literal, yeah. Like, we need this and this, because in those spaces, I'm working on a smaller way, which is why I love working with those spaces. But yeah, if I ever got someone saying, here's carte blanche to do what you want in a theater, I'd be like, okay, we got to get a lot of fight choreographers. We got to get some wire work. And I would do a big old school epic.
Yeah. That sounds pretty sweet.
It would be so fun. Oh yeah. My God.
You've written a lot about Chicago. You've talked a lot about Chicago. You've talked about the mayor. You've talked about the school closures. You've got it as an artist. You have a real and I don't know about you as a citizen, as a person, but I know as a writer, you have a very intimate relationship with the place where we are right now, or where you live. Do you see Chicago on a positive trajectory at the moment? Are we moving in the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think getting Rahm Emanuel out of office is the best thing that could happen to the city in a while. I think after that, getting Bruce Rauner out of his seat is one of the best things to happen to Chicago in a decade.
Mm-hmm.
I also think with the alderman elections coming up and a lot of small city elections coming up in February, if we actually change what City Hall looks like, if we change those 50 seats, or 51 in this case, then I think the city will change. I think there's been a lot of residual white flight and fear of any kind of brown person of color in charge. But yeah, I think we're on our way to getting a lot more women in these seats. I think we're on our way to getting a lot more black and brown men in these seats. And I think once that happens, my weird transatlantic accent happens. I think once the city top to bottom looks like the actual racial makeup of Chicago, which is over 60% people of color, mostly black and Latino. I think once we actually put those people into power and stop listening to these white aldermen, I was at this alderman bout, I'll call it. It was like a discussion with all these people running for alderman, but the person who'd been alderman for over 30 years said that the black and brown people in his community should thank him for watching out for the that several million-dollar police amphitheater stadium that they built. He said it was the best thing to happen to you people for decades. You know, this is a man who doesn't care about his people. But since he has power over a community mostly black and brown, to the outside, when they hear Chicago, they're like, oh, they don't take care of their own. Mm-hmm. But what I think people don't realize is that the media slants it this way. And by media, I mean very specific outlets. I do not mean everyone reporting about Chicago. But I think on a national level, when you have the president saying these filthy things about our city, and people not realizing that there are people here who are fighting to have their voices heard, but for decades, there have been white men in power who have not let that happen. I think if February goes in a really good way, these new people who are young and opinionated and powerful,
mm-hmm.
They could really take back the city and make it mean something more.
Mm-hmm. And if your saga is over with Lottery Day, what's the future for the 51st Ward? Is it positive? Do you have an optimistic view of the future of the 51st Ward?
Of the 51st Ward, I think it'll be, 51st Ward is different from Chicago. I'm rewriting every day. I don't want to say anything too
spoiler
plain about it, but I will say that the last two plays show you a very clear direction of what's going to happen. And if someone were to produce all seven of these plays, please do. If someone were just to do that, I think you would see about a decade-long journey of a place that used to be thriving, switched to surviving, and then the end, we will see with these last three shows what that ends up looking like. But yeah, I'm always optimistic about Chicago as a city.
Right on. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate
Thank you for having me.
All right, take it easy.
Holla!
Thank you, Ike, and thank you, Victory Gardens, for the use of your theater. Ike's play, Rightland, opens November 18th. Go to victorygardens.org for tickets and information. As Ike mentioned, several of the plays from his saga, sorry I called it a cycle, are playing in Chicago, culminating in Lottery Day, the final play in the saga, opening at the Goodman Theater in March of 2019. All right, to the credits. Music at the beginning was from Blue Dot Sessions. The music playing right now is from Scott Holmes. The theme song for the subtext is from International Pen Pal. Thanks to American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group, and thank you for listening and sharing this podcast with all the great people in your life. And thank you for rating it on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or wherever podcasts can be found. I love them comments and 5-star reviews, so keep them coming. This is the end of the episode. The play filling me up this month is Fabulous Monsters by Diana Bourbono. Check out this play, friends. I love it.